All right, welcome back. So again, if I'm talking in this volume, anyone having trouble hearing in the room? Okay, if I get quiet, just wave or something and I can make adjustments. And it's okay online? Good. Thank you for the thumbs up. All right, so as I mentioned, we're continuing with this year-long exploration of the Four Noble Truths, of kind of the foundational teachings of the Buddha. So first noble truth is that there is dukkha or suffering. Second noble truth, that there's a cause, that it's actually origination of that suffering. Third noble truth, there's a cessation of that suffering. And then the fourth is that there's a path leading to the cessation. Fourth is also the Eightfold Path. So that's what we're really into right now for the rest of the year, is taking one of those folds each month to explore. So last month we explored wise view or right view. And then this month we're exploring wise intention, or also called right intention. So intentionality in general, I think it's important to kind of just highlight for a moment, because it's often something that happens without us really realizing what our intentions are. We're just kind of acting almost from reactivity or a sense of kind of quickness. And sometimes when we really want to have a clear outcome, we kind of reflect on our intention to have a clearer way of manifesting that. Now, intention is really the driver of all our actions. It precedes the actions and defines the nature of those actions. So this, we'll get into this, kind of there's a subtlety around it. For an example, I like to use checkout people, cashiers, like in a grocery store, because it's a nice way to practice. Because, usually don't know the person. It's easy to kind of just ignore them or just kind of see them as part of the scenery. But to actually practice connecting with them is a nice informal practice. And often I find when I ask them how they're doing, if I do that sincerely, they often share, more. Because it's a busy job. It's a hard job. You got cranky customers complaining, hurrying. You're always going too long of a wait. But to have a little bit of connection goes a long ways. So intentionality, let's say I'm in a line, I've been waiting for a while, and I can see the person's busy. I can have, let's say, two possible intentions. There's many more, but let's say there's one intention of connection. The other intention is of disconnection. So I follow the second one. I don't connect. I just kind of keep my eyes down, bare minimal of conversation. Now, if I want to connect, if that's my intention, then my actions flow from that intention of looking them in their eye, asking sincerely, how's it been? How's the day going? How much longer in your shift? Maybe make a comment upon what's going on in the store. And that's a very different intention that leads to a different form of action. So any action that we do has a level of intentionality behind it. Sometimes it's a very light intention. Sometimes it's a very strong intention. And that's the strength of an intention often leads to kind of how that action is received or how it manifests. So mindfulness practice, one way to think of it, is it slows down this kind of quick process. Like if you're watching a video, the things go by so quickly you can't see what happens. Go in half speed or quarter speed. You can start to see all the little nuances of action of an athlete or a bunny hopping across the floor or whatever it is you're watching. That's what mindfulness allows us to do. You start to notice kind of the little bits of action that happen or the things that precede. And you can start to see that an action that you're doing, there's an intention that precedes it. If you're on a meditation retreat, like I know some of you just were with Carrie and myself, you can start to notice in walking meditation, the intention to turn around, the intention to get up from a sit, the intention to go to sit. There's this little bit of choice, this little bit of decision that arises first, and then our actions flow from that. Usually they happen so quickly we don't even register that intention. Making that intentionality more conscious then allows us to live more skillfully. And you start to overlay this whole wise aspect from the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That starts to connect us with really the depth of the Dharma. And in this way, this piece, this one link, of intentionality really connects with the next link, which is wise action. So Eightfold Path, very quickly, there's three aspects. There's the wisdom aspect, which includes wise view, wise intention. There's the action aspect, which includes wise action, wise speech, wise livelihood. And the final aspect is that of cultivation. So that's wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. So we often spend a lot of time practicing the mindfulness part, right? The concentration part, the wise effort part. But it's meant to be part of this whole. It's meant to cultivate and generate wisdom and understanding, and that wisdom is meant to show up in our lives. And so the Eightfold Path is really a strong statement that the Buddha taught from, that how we practice needs to show up in our lives, the way we actually interact with others, how we speak, how we use our bodies, how we use our energy, how we make a livelihood. So we'll explore that in the coming months, those particular ones. So wise intention is kind of that strong link into action. Now, wise intention, or intention in general, is something that arises in the moment. It arises right here and right now. So we might kind of rehearse the intention or clarify it, but it's really something that's showing up right now, that choice point. How am I going to choose to interact? And this is something that really links into the first fold path, or fold of the Eightfold Path, which is wise view. So wise view, if the shorthand is just understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding what causes suffering, what releases that suffering. So, and that's, you can look at that intellectually, you can look at it in a very deep way, a very experiential way. And one of the benefits of being meditators is we can take all of these Dharma concepts and see them real time in our lives. We can actually see how they show up moment by moment in a very concrete, real way. You know, like last month I talked about wise view a little bit. And we can look at kind of the different three unwholesome roots. So let's say there's a root of greed that's kind of the view that I'm coming from. Okay, that sense of separation, that sense of scarcity, that sense of lack. And let's say there's something that I find interesting or attractive that I want more of. That sets the intentionality to reach for it. And then the body reaches for it. You know, it goes for it. And that's that kind of that link. Or I could, you know, see a wise aspect of that. A wise part of non-greed, a sense of generosity. Okay, maybe there's an act of something that I can give. The intentionality rises, and then the action follows from that. So wise view is also very connected to wise intention. Without the view, you know, the intention won't arise. So this is something that's even more unconscious than I even realize the basic assumptions that we're operating with. So view is, again, we unpacked that a lot last month. We can think of it as kind of the basic assumptions that we take as true, the basic premise that we're living from in our lives, right? So to kind of modernize this kind of archaic language from a psychological perspective, let's say my basic view in the world is that there's something fundamentally flawed with me, right? That fundamental belief then filters the way I act. It filters the way my intention arises. I'm trying to disprove that, or I'm trying to earn love. I'm trying to argue that, or I'm trying to hide myself. I'm trying to go into shame. All those are, you can track that. That's the view. The intentionality arises to hide or to try to please or whatever it might be, all the codependency that arises. And then from that place, the actions flow from that. And then we start to practice, and we start to change those views in a very fundamental way. Now, the fundamental bottom line piece is what causes happiness. I mean, ultimately, this practice is about a happiness, a sense of joy that's outside of conditions, that's outside of circumstances. Right? If we're honest, you know, like for a lot of my life has been trying to find that happiness based on the conditions. Right? It's like, I'm going to be much happier if I-5 was clear and open versus stuck in a traffic jam, right? Right? So it's not that I don't have preferences, but if my happiness really depends upon I-5 looking a certain way, I'm going to be upset most of the time. But yet, if there's a sense of happiness and ease that's not dependent upon the circumstances, then there's more of that buoyancy. Okay, same thing with youth. You know, does my body need to be always a 20-year-old body? Or what do I do when my body ages? How do I accommodate that? You know, and that kind of trying to get back to those states. There's a lot of suffering because, you know, we're just going one direction. Unfortunately, right? Sickness, you know, loss, grief, illness, all these things. These are part of the worldly winds that buffeted the Buddha and really promoted him to start to practice, to find this joy that's outside of that. So this is a big fundamental piece of wise view, is understanding in a very deep way what causes true happiness. You know, is it, if it's really getting the right possessions and the right circumstances, all our energy flows from that. And yet, we all know at some point, anything we own we will lose it. It will go away from us. Either it will lose it, or be taken from us, or we ourselves will die, will pass away. And yet, there's another way of being happy that's outside of that. And we practice that in meditation. I mean, once we kind of get the mind a little bit more settled down, it's not so squirrely, we're stopped fighting with the mind, there can be this access to this moment-by-moment ease. How the moment actually is sufficient in of itself. I myself am sufficient as I am. So wise view is really integral to how intention shows up and how wise intention shows up. So intention is this important connector between our wisdom and our understanding and how we act in the world. We can have all the wisdom in the world, but if we don't act from that, it's a very limited value. If you don't bring intentionality to kind of give expression to it, to bring voice to it, to embody it, it's very limited. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about the Eightfold Path is the Buddha explicitly said, actions, it's a third of it. It's three factors around how we act in the world. Now, intentionality is also interesting. There's a lot of emphasis on it from a traditional Buddhist perspective because of its karmic actions, karmic potential. Okay, so when we say karma, we got to kind of unpack that a little bit because often in our society we use words like, oh, it's my karma, or you know, karmic payback or instant karma. There's these ways we kind of talk about it and kind of trying to understand this bigger concept. Karma or kama from the Pali is simply action, especially volitional action, intentional action. Right? So intention, choosing to do something has a certain momentum behind it. So we can see this in a very, you know, mundane, easy way. It's something that I tend to do, I'm going to tend to do more of it, right? Let's say that every time you came to Seattle Insight, afterwards you had a habit of going to Dairy Queen or something like that. That would start to become this habit that, okay, I just have to do it. It's this momentum, kind of this habit that starts to form, these neurological pathways. There's also the way that we are in the world that becomes, it's harder to track that one-to-one ratio. And this is also this important aspect of karma that happens. That basically, if we act in a way that's, I remember my wife and I, we had some debt, and we decided to stop debting. We had this deep commitment to stop debting after that. This kind of this deep, you know, kind of looking at that situation, understanding more clearly, and made this deep resolution. And from that moment forward, life became more and more abundant from that simple choice, right? So that's part of that karmic expression. I couldn't track that sort of would happen, but that's how it did. Now the Buddha explicitly said too that, because people would ask him about karma and try to help him try to understand it. And he said, Don't try to understand. It's me being fully enlightened. It's so complex, the cause and effect and how it goes through time and through different lifetimes. It's too complex to try to figure out. You know, just know that your actions do have consequences. Where they show up, how they show up, we can't predict. But they do have a potential. So one way to hold it is in this moment, whatever conditions happen, whether it was last week or last year, or if you believe in lifetimes ago, the moment's showing up in this certain way. Right? How you meet it, that's what the power is. How can I meet this moment as fully as I can? How can I meet it with clarity, with as much compassion and as much as wisdom? That's all you have to know about this. And if I meet it from a place of maybe reactivity or of anger or of judgment or a sense of, really unconsciousness or a quality of really these unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion, that has a certain momentum that starts to set up. Now, one way to think about it with this one link here of wise intention is if you've ever done archery, you draw back the bow and you aim at something. And when you're aiming, that's that intentionality. Sometimes wise intention is also called wise aim. Right? So I'm choosing to focus on one thing. Okay, so just like with the bow, I could just have the arrow resting without pulling back the string and point it at something. There's not a lot of power right there. There's no power at all. But there's still kind of a weak intentionality there. Or I can pull back the string a little bit. There's a little bit more force. I can pull it back further. I can pull it back all the way. Really load the bow. That puts a lot of force behind it. It's the same thing with intentionality, that we can really have a lot of strong intentions for better or worse that carries more weight, if you will. Right? So if you just kind of quickly react to something, there's not much weight. But if you're really pondering it, like let's say we decided we want to rob a house and we're like thinking about it and looking at it and planning it for days and weeks. That's a lot of, not the bow's getting really drawn back. Right? So it's going to have a lot of energy that has to resolve in some way. Right? Same too if we really reflect on something like generosity or kindness or compassion. And we really dwell that. How can I act in a really compassionate way? And this is some of the really, in some ways difficult, but also very powerful ways to practice as lay people. So people who have jobs and families and relationships and don't have like haven't released everything like a monk or a nun mind. You have lots of things to practice with. You can really practice in, I have a difficult conversation to have. How can I bring a level of compassion to it? How can I bring a level of wisdom to that interaction? How can I not act from a place of harm in this? Those are all questions of intentionality. There's all questions of how can we bring the wisdom to that intentionality? How can I bring wisdom to how I'm meeting that? Now, intention, this is a little bit of an aside, but I think it's also important. Sometimes we reflect on our action and we think, okay, my intention was good. I didn't have a sense of ill will, or I didn't have a sense of greed with that, or a sense of kindness. And yet the effect of the action is not received very well, right? Have you ever had that happen? It kind of blows up. It causes, there's this impact that happens. And so this is one of the teachings that's come out recently in the last, I don't know how many years, maybe 10 years or so. But notice the difference between our intention and our impact, right? So the intentionality may feel like it's clean, may feel like it's clear, but the impact of it isn't so much. And that's just part of the message of listening to the feedback of life, the feedback of people around you, people that you care about. So there's often that there's an unconsciousness that kind of transforms our actions in a way that causes some difficulty or outright harm. One example is around like the systemic nature of racism. So as a white man, you know, I'm kind of at the top of the way the system's set up, right? It's like everything's kind of built to support me. And if I'm not conscious of that, I'm not aware of that support, I can misuse my power and my influence. I can, you know, step up and say something and not realizing that that's kind of asserting that power. That's asserting that privilege. You know, and to realize that people who are more marginalized, you know, basically half the population in the females, anyone, a person of color or a BIPOC person, there's this way that there's this suppression. That if I'm not conscious of that, I can think I'm following a good intention. But if I'm not aware of it, the impact can still be very harmful. So to be aware of that. And that's part of it's hard to hear that, to understand that, but that's part of the nature of things. That's how we start to grow, you know, have care for ourselves and others in more and more deep ways. Not by going into a sense of shame or collapse when we do those kind of things, but to a chance to learn. A chance to understand more fully. Let me understand this nature of something that's unclear. You know, I think we all have aspects of this with our psychology. The way we were raised has certain assumptions of how we should be in families, different experiences that we've had, you know, traumatic experiences, levels of abuse. All these things shape the way we perceive the world. You know, and so sometimes that comes out in distorted ways. And so listening to the feedback, even though your intentionality may feel initially, okay, that was clean, that was good, come back and re-examine. See if there's something deeper to learn from that. So intention versus impact. Now, traditionally, there's three main types of wise intention. Okay, the intention of non-harm, the intention of non-ill will, and renunciation. Right, so let's talk about those a little bit. So non-harm. So non-harm we could sometimes translate in a positive way of kindness, of interconnection. A lot of Buddhist terms are translated in the negative, what it's not. Right? So it's kind of interesting to notice that. And one of the reasons I heard or read about this is that if we translated something in the positive, it gives the mind something more to cling on to. One example of this is nirvana or awakening. So we could talk about all the positive ways of describing enlightenment, but that becomes something the mind to kind of grasp on, to kind of hold on to. But if we talk about it as the word nirvana is actually the cooling, the quenching, the turning off of the fires, that's like it's what it's not. And so we know, okay, maybe it's not this, it's not this, and that allows us to be open to actually discovering what it actually is. So it's similar with non-harm. Kind of holding that, how can I have a quality of non-harm in my actions? Right. Now, non-harm is one of those interesting ones because we often harm because we are hurt ourselves. We feel scared, we feel threatened, we feel attacked. You know? And so that's where this whole teaching between wise view, wise intention, and wise action really helps. So you start to feel there's this impulse to lash out. To lash out verbally, to lash out through email, to lash out through direct messaging or texting or whatever expression that might be, using some familiar gesture outside the window of the car. So there's this impulse, all right, that arises. So usually we just follow that. But being meditators, we can feel the impulse. We can say, maybe that's a little bit, you know, maybe that's maybe not as clean as it could be. Like if I took this cup and I threw it at the window, I have an impulse. As soon as it releases my hand, I can't take it back, right? It's like you hit send on the email, and it's like, how often have you done that? It's like, ooh, wish I read that a little bit more closely before it got sent. Or maybe they haven't read it yet. That's that impulse to throw. So I can feel that, like an impulse to act. So if that comes from a place of harm, you can feel that intentionality. I want to lash out. I want to hurt. I want to cause discomfort to this person or damage to this person. So you start to feel that. That can be a really important clue or cue to be present. Then be open to that feeling of wanting to cause harm, to wanting to destroy, to kill, however it might show up. And then from that place, I can notice the place of view that's coming from. And part of it, seeing there's this psychological, maybe there's a sense of inner pain, this sense that triggered me very deeply. There's a sense of being attacked. Maybe there's a sense of fear. And maybe I've projected my past upon this situation. And I can see how my view is kind of distorted. Right? So then it comes back to that view. What causes more suffering? What causes the release of that suffering? The more clear I am with that, that starts to change how the intentionality shows up. The actions flow from a different place. So non-ill will is an intention. This is actually a really, I think, helpful one right now, this day and age. Sorry, just checking the chat there. I don't know if you're at all like my mind, but there's some scenario or situation in the world, or maybe some person, that's easy to feel some hatred toward. To feel some ill will toward that arises, right? Whoever that might be for you. And so practicing, this is a fun way to practice it. I always say fun, but it is fun, actually. It is fun because once you do it a few times, you realize, oh, this actually liberates my heart. You know, it's not fun if you're caught in it. It's not fun if you're lost in it, if you don't have a choice in it. But it is fun if you start to realize, oh, my mind's doing this thing. Right? So let's say I open up my phone in the morning and I see, oh, here's this news. Okay? And it's like, oh my goodness, what's happening here? I can't believe this is happening. And I can feel that tightness. All right. And there's then this intention to think hateful thoughts, to have ill will arise. Right? So the intention arises and then I start to think about it. Right. So then that's already going into action. And I got some, I don't know if it's good news and bad news. In Buddhist thought and philosophy, action includes what you think. Includes your thoughts. All right. So it's not just how you speak. It's not just how you use your body. It's not just your livelihood. It's also how you think. All right. And this is bad news because, you know, obviously. But it's good news, too, because that means you can choose how much energy you put into those thoughts. There's this one sutta where the Buddha, before he became awakened, he just realized, wow, there's these thoughts which lead to more suffering. And there's these thoughts that lead to more freedom. Once have I just divided my thoughts into these two piles and put my energy into the ones that led to more freedom, to less suffering, instead of the ones that go cause more suffering. So see how that's a choice of intentionality, how intentionality has that choice going toward that. So ill will, you know, there's a gift in these day and age to be able to, this day and age to practice with that, to practice where the mind goes. Okay, so non-ill will doesn't mean we condone, it doesn't mean we accept, it doesn't mean we don't fight or, you know, argue and try to assert what we think is true. But we don't go into that harshness of heart. We don't bring in that quality of hatred into our heart. And the primary reason not to do that is because hatred hurts ourselves. Hatred hurts our own hearts because it creates a level of division. So non-ill will. And the third one is of renunciation. Right, the renunciation. So we can look at we could say non-greed would be another way of saying it. But non-greed, so we can start to see that quality of hunger, that quality of wanting. There's this, in Buddhist cosmology, there's these different kind of realms. And one of the realms is the realm of the hungry ghost. These beings have insatiable appetites, these huge stomachs, but very small mouths. So they have to work constantly to try to satiate themselves and never come close to that. And I think all these realms, you know, we can think of it however you like to, you know, think of it as these actual realms. We can also just see them as aspects of the human experience, that when we're lost in craving, in wanting, in greed, that there's this sense of wanting something to kind of fill this deep lack in ourselves, whether it's a substance or food or relationships or sex or whatever it might be. It never actually fulfills that. So you can see how intentionality from a place of greed, yeah, of course, a lot of our actions flow from that. But as meditators, we start to know that terrain. We feel when we're going into that pathway of greed, that pathway of deep wanting, you know, that deep desire. not a healthy kind of desire, but the desire of that lack. And we bring our attention to it. We slow down this process of intentionality and action, right? So this is, I'm kind of talking fairly strongly here. One of the biggest traps we can get into as meditators is to use these teachings to find a new thing to judge about ourselves, all right? It's like, oh my intention is so bad, you know, all right? Try to not go down that pathway because it's not going to work. You can trust me on that. I've tried it. What does work, though, is have this basic friendliness of attention toward yourself. It's kind of like my mind can think whatever it wants. It can have any kind of impulse that arises, as long as it just arises. But then there's a choice point of not following it, right? So, because if it arises and I get reactive and judge myself, that just kind of makes the whole thing more tight. I'm judging the fact that I'm judging, for example. But if that judgment arises, I can notice it, feel it as in my body, get freedom, a sense of freedom from acting from it, freedom from the intentionality. So intentionality is this important link between, you know, our view and our actions. And so we're bringing a lot of energy to our intentions this month to see how they shape, how they show up. We're taking something which is usually unconscious and making it conscious. You know, sometimes there's a big choice we're trying to make, a big decision, and we naturally slow it down. We can start to slow it down in these small, easy ways. Can I see that movement toward something, that movement to act? Check back and see what the intention is that's driving that. Notice when you're able to connect with an intention that's wise, and notice when you don't, and see it as a chance to learn about yourself, to learn that maybe there's something that needs compassion, some hurt, some anger that's here. So intentionality in general and wise intention is really our responsibility as human beings, as meditators, is to be aware of that. How is our intentionality showing up? Is it an intention of ill will, or is it of non-harm? Is it of kindness? Is it of generosity? And start to follow that, start to listen to that, and see how life starts to open up in that way. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, and then we'll open to any questions you might have. As we sit together for a few moments, you can even notice the intentionality that's here right now. The intention of being present, of being connected, and how that can have this expression of wise intention, of meeting this moment, just how it is. Before we open to any questions or sharing you might have about this topic or about Dharma in general, just talk about the homework. So those online, I did put in the chat, and Kim, maybe you could repost that for people. I'm just going to go over that real quickly. Next week, Tuari Salah will be here teaching. The week after will be Carrie Peterson, and then Tuari Salah will be back again, and I'll be back on the 30th. So we're going to be doing this hopscotch, all the guiding teachers here this month. So we won't have the same chance to dialogue and do these discussions. But I think it's so important to engage around this topic. And you can talk among yourselves. You can find a Dharma buddy and explore these topics. It can really make the practice very rich to be able to express things, articulate, and also to hear other people's journey around it. So start to notice the link between your intentions and your actions, just in general. You know, how any action that you do, there is some intention, maybe a quick microsecond of intention, or maybe you kind of took it up for a while. When contemplating an action, inquire about what intention is driving it. So, okay, I want to do something. What's the intention behind it? Is it of kindness? Is it of separation? Is it of connection? You can look at those three that I talked about, of non-harm, non-ill will, or renunciation, or you can find your own ways of expressing that. And then notice what view is shaping that intention. You know, what's the assumption that I'm living from? How I view myself and others? And then try cultivating those three wholesome intentions of non-harm, non-ill will, and renunciation. Right? So you just say, okay, I want to make this action in a place of non-harm. I want to act from non-ill will. I want to act from a place of generosity, of renunciation. And be compassionate with the times your intention is unwholesome. And explore the view behind those intentions without judging yourself. All right? So let's open to any questions. So usually our format, we have a mic that comes around and we can all hear each other. But our system kind of had some issues today. So I'm going to have to just paraphrase the questions. So you can speak and I'll make sure both online and in person can hear. So online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. And in person, you can raise your physical hand. Yes?
This is building on something you said at some point in the middle of the talk. When I anticipate doing the homework and I feel very drawn to it,
yes.
Like how does one stay in the space of curiosity and not tip over into over-vigilantly watching yourself trying to set your attention?
Yes. So the question is around with the homework, you know, feeling drawn to it. And what's the balance between kind of being over vigilant around it versus being curious? You know, that kind of openness to see what was here. Well, it's like notice making the hypervigilance. I mean, this gets a little, you know, subtle, but there's a whole view that goes up with that. Right? I mean, you can actually make that the first homework, the whole first application. Right. So there's the mind. It's like this. There's kind of a way that the vigilance has a whole assumptions around it that I want to be a good student. I want to get a lot out of it. I don't want to do it wrong. I want to, you know, do all these kind of things. If I do it wrong, then, you know, all those things that come up. That's all kind of an assumption that's loading, that's shaping, that makes vigilance make sense. Right. Versus then the view of curiosity, the view of interest. It's like, okay, maybe it doesn't matter what's here. Maybe what matters is my relationship to it. Can I open to it? Can I let the lessons be not something that I force, but more just kind of I'm seeing directly? It's like if Narayan Libinson, you know, I teach a lot with her at her center at Cambridge. They have, when they get flowers, fresh flowers, she has them just leave them there till they're decaying and falling down. Because that's a teaching in itself, right? So there's a teaching that just by being present, just letting it observe. So part of it is letting the mind relax that wants to figure it out and bringing that quality of curiosity with it. And it's really, that's this whole practice is what view am I bringing forth? Does that help a little bit? Great, thank you for the question. Yes, go ahead, Anne.
I'm interested in renunciation, but this weekend we were talking about renunciation, not, I don't think from a Greek perspective, but we were announcing things like for me, I have a strong tendency to want to fix things.
Right.
And so I'm curious about how that fits into this. Like,
sure. Yeah, so the question is around, some of the members of the board and some of the leadership were on a weekend workshop around changes and transitions. And so one of the kind of the practices was renouncing judging, comparing, and fixing mind. Right? So these deep patterns. And when we renounce those, there's this capacity to be open to how the moment actually is, you know, like the last question. Now, in terms of how this fits in with intentionality, it really fits in very strongly, actually, because if we you know, just looking at it from the framework, you look at it from different frameworks, but from the Eightfold Path, the view of comparing, the view that allows comparing to come forth, the view that allows judging to come forth and fixing, those all have a basic assumption, right? There's something fundamentally wrong with the moment, that I need to be better or improved. There's this level of the moment's not quite right, or something's not right out there or in here, right? And of course, psychologically, we could tie that into lots of fun, interesting patterns too, right? but the bottom line from a Buddhist perspective is, what causes suffering, right? Does judging cause suffering? Does fixing cause suffering? Does comparing cause suffering? So you're seeing it from that perspective. Okay, that's causing more suffering. The releasing of those is releasing of that suffering. So see how it kind of ties in? Why is view defining by understanding what causes suffering, what releases that suffering? Intentionality is how you express that. Judging is going to be a good way to express what causes suffering. Does that tie together? Yeah, thank you. All right, anyone else? And online, yeah, make sure you raise your virtual hand because I may not see your physical hand. Yes, yeah, go ahead.
It's not clear the difference between no harm, no ill will, and the same intention.
Yes, yeah, it's a good question. So the question is around the difference between non-ill will and non-harm. So yeah, they are similar, but basically ill will is kind of more of that kind of relationship to something, someone or something else or some part of myself that I'm just kind of hating it. There's that way of kind of contracting around the mind around it. Harm is actually, you know, physically going out and causing damage or internally causing damage. So not ill will and harm, they often really go together. You know, but I can harm someone without really having ill will to them, right? I can see a cockroach and just crush it. You won't really have cockroaches up here, do you? I grew up in New Mexico. We have cockroaches. But, you know, like a mosquito, you know, we can just, I don't really hate the mosquitoes. Like, if I saw it, like, oh, I hate this thing, and then I crush it, I've added ill will, and I've added harm. Yeah, so there are a lot of connections, but they also can be separate. Does that help? Yeah. All right, go ahead, Carla. Let me turn. Oops, let's see. I think we got to give you permission to speak. Oops. And turn the volume up. Can you unmute now?
Yes, I think I'm unmuted.
Can you hear me? Good. Yeah, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, because I sometimes have trouble with my audio, so if I cut out, let me know. You said something kind of early on in your talk that really caught my attention and that I'm curious to know more about. I think you said something about when we've been planning an action for a long time. You gave the example of planning a robbery, and we've really sort of cultivated, in this case, that negative intention for days and weeks, and then we act on it. You said, I think you said there's an amount of energy behind the intention and the amount of karma that would generate that's different from perhaps spontaneously committing a blunder that we hadn't, where there wasn't any conscious intention, but we may have acted on skillfully in more of a spontaneous way. Can you say more about how you think about that difference? Because when I think about myself, it's interesting. I've had the experience, of course, of having an impulse and then taking time to contemplate it and then seeing a more wise path and refraining from harmful action. But I've also noticed that sometimes the mind can be so caught in its habitual view that even though there's a part of me that has more wisdom and that realizes I might be causing harm if I act this way, so I refrain and I think about it for a few days. Sometimes the habit mind still wins over and finds a justification for unskillful action. And then there is an incredible, there's almost more energy behind the amount of harm I then cause, because then I've become so invested in justifying this action rather than if I'd done something unskillful spontaneously. But then spontaneous harm comes from a place of, you know, probably complete ignorance. So I don't know if that's less karma. So can you explain more about that?
Sure. Could everyone hear that or not? Anyone not be able to hear it? Should I repeat it? You couldn't hear it? Okay. So just to kind of paraphrase that, it's around the sense of when we really rehearse something or plan something, how that has more of a kind of a karmic power to it, or potential is probably a better way to say it, planning a robbery, you know, rehearsing it. But how sometimes, and how if you have like a spontaneous action, there's not a lot of intention behind it and we still act. And how does that relate to something that we're kind of grappling with? Like, okay, you know, it's probably not the best thing, but, you know, I want to do it, and then kind of go back and forth, and finally I do it. And how there has it, how does that all shape up with everything? And it's, on one hand, it's partly I'm wondering, you know, how useful it is to try to sort all that out. Because if we really looked at the whole thing you described, kind of that pondering, that reflecting, you know, should I do this or not? And when I finally do what I don't think I should do, and, you know, how, what's the effects of that? There's also all the kind of sub-actions that are coming off that. It's like, isn't it like when tornadoes happen, they can spawn secondary tornadoes? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like that. We have this big tornado, but then we're kind of thinking about it, and there's these other sub-tornadoes of action. And pretty soon we're like, I can't do anything. Because, you know, we're going to cause all this havoc in our lives. So what I would suggest is try to, how can I simplify this whole process? How can I make it as simple as possible? And most actions really have a mixture. You know, not everything is pure, right? Like, did anyone have to drive here, right? Was there any impact in that driving? You know, can you guarantee you didn't hit any bugs? Did you affect global warming at all? I mean, there's all these choices that we have. And so it's kind of just kind of weighing it, but we can get paralyzed by trying to make everything, you know, just the right thing. So I try to see too, I was talking with Carrie about this actually, is kind of what's the best fit for understanding something. And sometimes we choose, okay, we're going to pick wise intention for this month. And we're kind of trying to make everything fit it. But sometimes it's not the right fit. You know, sometimes when I'm pondering something, maybe it's understanding. Actually, this weekend we talked about the nature of ambiguity versus ambivalence and understanding that whole dynamic. And maybe that's a better fit for how can I really learn and grow around this? How can I learn to have a sense of skillfulness around it? The karmic question may not be such a big piece. The karma is going to really come up around things I'm hating, things I'm really causing harm to, and when I'm really acting from a place of greed, you know, in a really strong way. That's when it really activates. All right, did that help, Carla? I kind of danced around the question a little bit. But
What I'm taking away is to maybe try to simplify and also look at how the mind, it has to do with proliferation too, I guess, right?
We're
caught in ambiguity and justifying back and forth. There's a lot of proliferation where I think I could simplify and just go back to, does it cause more suffering or does it cause more freedom?
That's right. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, simplifying, because the proliferation, it's kind of those side tornadoes. It just kind of adds this whole other dynamic, or makes things more complex. But yeah, that's I think what's the simplest way I can look at it? You know, what causes suffering? What causes harm? Another one is kind of going back to view. You know, what's the view? What's kind of my values in my life? You know, again, you know, this workshop is still fresh in my mind, but that's, you know, Philip also wrote that an article about that based on his book on the Four Noble Truths. But anyway, that sense of, you know, view is also going to be our values. What do we really value? What's most important to me in this situation? You know, maybe not there's a whole life, but there's also maybe this situation. Maybe honesty is the most important value. Maybe kindness is the most value, important. And sometimes that helps clarify that sense of ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. All right, so we have Deanna and Bo. Let's see, let me ask you to unmute. Okay, there we go.
I think, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, and this is Bo. Hi. Thank you for the talk. My question is also about non-ill will. I think like of the three, that one feels to be the one that's most sort of, I don't know, internal or in the mind or in the heart. And I heard that you said the, you know, thoughts are also actions. What I find, what I experience with ill will when I notice it coming up, and I do sometimes notice it come up, you know, you alluded to us, maybe a certain political situation where it comes up, but it comes up in small ways a lot too. What I'm trying to learn how to do better is when, you know, that when I notice that feeling come up, when I notice the ill will or the hatred, the impulses to sort of try to make it go away or try to stop feeling that or stop thinking that. And I, you know, I'm thinking of, there's a book called, I think, like, Don't Think of an Elephant. You know, it's like, as soon as you say that, you can't not think of it. And so I guess my question is, what is your advice for, you know, when ill will, when I notice that ill will arises, what is a more skillful way to release it than just sort of trying to push it away or try to tell myself to stop hating or stop having ill will?
Yeah, great. So just to repeat that question, when ill will arises, what's the best way to work with it? You know, because we can have a sense of trying to stop it or ignore it or repress it, but that just tends to strengthen it, you know, and how is it much a more skillful way? Is that basically the question?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Could I ask someone to fill up my water for me? I'm having to talk a little bit. Thank you. Just straight ahead. Sorry about that. Having to project a little bit more than I normally do. So in terms of the ill will and how to work with it, it's tricky because it's so easy to have ill will toward the ill will, right? And I think that's kind of the crux of it, because that ultimately won't work, because ill will toward ill will is just going to kind of go distortions into repression or into, thank you very much, into go into depression if we're really repressing it, come out sideways, or we kind of play nice and then suddenly we blow up. Like, do you remember that? I did that sutta on the simile of the saw, where there's this woman who's pretending to be really nice, but really isn't, and her servant kind of tests her until she kind of really loses her cool. So ill will toward ill will doesn't work. So what other capacity can I bring forth to it, to meet it? And that's really a capacity of mindfulness, a capacity of compassion, this quality of kindness. You know, how can I meet this experience? And so what I like to do is kind of really separate out the actual impulse that's arising of ill will and the actions that flow from it. And part of that is the intentionality to act, right? So I can feel that ill will arise. I can feel the tightness in the heart. I can feel all that. And I go into the body sense of it. I can feel how the mind distorts around it. but I'm kind of putting my foot off the gas. I'm not trying to follow that impulse. And then often by doing that, I can kind of ask often a tender question. Okay, what's really this about? You know, is it a sense of fear? Is it a sense of hurt? Is it a sense of injustice, unfairness? And letting that be felt in a very kind of kind way, a tender way. Right? So often it's really the pathway is to have this inner compassion for yourself. And then from there, you can start to turn toward the other person if it's something external. Start to reflect that, well, you know, how happy are they really? And how much suffering is in their minds? You know, there's one individual that comes to mind that has a lot of suffering. There's a lot of internal suffering. There's this huge, what's the right word? What's that?
Projection.
There's the projection, but I was thinking just the you know, he's on a big screen, you know, he's acting it out in the big way. Big radius, yeah. There's lots of words you can use for it. This isn't quite the right one, but that's fine. But you get the sense of it. You know, it's this big expression, but there's this pain that's underneath it. You know, so it's like living with the quality of compassion, right? So, and this is where it gets interesting because you can have this sense, because sometimes we think that we have to say no to something, or we have to stop something, or deny it, or stand up to it. We have to do that from a place of hatred. We have to bring up our energy. And that's one of the kind of the questions as an active practitioner is how can I be strong and forceful and clear without having to be a closed heart? You know, Sylvia Bordstein, I think, said, I might throw someone out of my life, but not out of my heart. Right? So that out of my heart goes into that quality of ill will. Does that help a bit, Bo?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, anyone back here in the room? Yeah, Noah.
How do you recommend one deal with ill will toward, or was like wrong intention, or intention to harm oneself?
Yes.
And repeatedly like look down on oneself.
Yes. Yeah, so this is an important question, is how do you deal with ill will toward oneself and that impulse to do that and the intentionality behind it? And this is, in some ways, this is kind of the fast track to how we solve how we are with other people. Because if that external hatred's coming out, there's often an internal hatred that's coming on too. So how do I care, you know, how do I care for myself? How do I bring attention to that quality of internal ill will? So first of all, you have to have some level of skepticism around it, right? That's kind of the first step, right? Because if you have those internal narratives and that internal self-hatred, basically, and we believe it, there's really no space around it. So there has to be some capacity to at least have some objectivity to it, and some sense of space around it. Like to notice, okay, there my voice is going down that self-judgment path, that self-diminishment path. And you can start to observe that and feel what it feels like. You're going to make it an actual object of attention. And then the next step is to start to interrupt the actions that flow from that. Right. So for myself, I had a very strong inner critic, right? A lot of self-hatred, self-diminishment. And so I would notice before I started, the first stage I started to notice it as experience. So I'd find myself, I would do something that I thought was klutzy or a mistake, and I would go down this whole narrative. Like, okay, I'm such an idiot. I'm always going to be klutzy, and no one's going to like me because I'm always doing that. And just kind of goes on and on and on. And I started to be able to observe that. And then I started to be able to observe it and start to cut the energy from it, to not add to it. It's like you're on this train that's going, starting to go down this way. You realize you're on the train and you jump off. I mean, but it's easy to jump off. you don't. You pull the bus stop and you get off the bus. Let's say that. That's better. So it'd be more like it started to be, I would literally notice this in my mind, would say, oh, I'm such an idiot, and then I would stop. And in that stopping, it'd be an interruption of the belief in that kind of suspending it, having a skepticism of it, coming into something else, maybe feeling the body's experience. The key piece is not to keep adding to it. So from the karmic perspective, the more I add to it, it just gets stronger and stronger. When I start to interrupt it, it becomes weaker and weaker. So eventually I could just feel like, oh, I'm such a, I would feel the impulse and then I would stop. Or sometimes even I'm and just stop. You know, so I became more and more free of it. Right? And then the next step is to start to investigate or inquire or become just this innocent curiosity, how the sense of you, the sense of I forms around that. Because that's one of the side that we don't often recognize that, but that's one of the big benefits of having a strong self-critic, is that it really forms a sense of you. When you're judging yourself, there's no ambiguity about who you are, right? You really know who you are. And if you release that, there's a sense of who am I outside of that. And so sometimes that's, if you're not aware of that, there's this energy to try to put us back into it. But the big thing is this willingness, this commitment not to keep causing more harm. The impulse to harm yourself through thought, internal narrative will come up. Be with it without acting from it as soon as you can. And then cultivating compassion, metta for yourself, you know, doing some effective transformational therapy can all, those are all very beneficial. Okay, does that help, Noah?
There's one more piece. There's this often tendency to rationalize, like, that, oh, it's different, like, harming others is far worse. Like, I can get away with harming myself because I know that. Because I know, because I see what it does, which is actually kind of wrong.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just what you just did right now. So the question, the reflection was that there's a justification that arises that harming others is much worse than harming myself. So then it's okay or something like that. But as he was saying that, he realized, well, that doesn't quite make sense. So sometimes it's like writing it out. It's like, it's okay to harm myself because it's worse to harm others. Like, let's see, wait a second. You know, that's one way to kind of articulate all this. Is kind of putting it on paper helps you see it, make it less abstract. And sometimes you look at it and says, okay, I don't know how I came up with that idea. That doesn't make much sense. And then here's another way to think of it too, is think of someone that you care about. You know, and would you want them harming themselves in the same way? Yeah. So kind of borrow that care for another person toward yourself. You know, with metta, you know, one way of practicing metta toward oneself, if it's hard to perceive it, is you have like a benefactor or a friend or someone that's easy to offer metta to. You imagine they're offering metta. They're seeing you from their eyes. They're offering metta to you and you're receiving it. To the best of your ability. I mean, it's one of these patterns which is very painful, it's very strong, and absolutely can become free of it. I'm saying that not from abstract, but from my own understanding, my own experience. And then life really is transformed by that. You're welcome. All right, Austin.
Tim, I thought, that was so beautiful, and I love the question. And for me, Tim, one of the things that I've been practicing with is just kind of relaxing the thinking and letting the heart kind of manifest itself and express it, right intention. And the Brahma Viharas are such a wonderful way. The qualities of the Buddha are another way, where I just simply will relax the thinking, come to the breath, and allow my heart to open up to some of those qualities of loving kindness, metta, some of the qualities of the Buddha, and just that simple intention of the heart kind of softens the thinking self and allows me to relax into, you know, what I believe is right intention. So I'd be curious to hear what you think about, you know, heart practice. You kind of alluded to it with metta, but other ways of setting intention without necessarily the cognitive process is taking place.
Yes. So just to paraphrase that, if you had trouble hearing Austin, yeah, absolutely. That sense of intentionality, I think ultimately it's not a cognitive process. It's more of kind of this felt sense or this heart quality. And the way you described it is this relaxing of the mind and allowing the heart to come forth. You know, we can, and that's, I think the simpler we can make it, the better. Like if I had like 20 things I had to go through with my intentionality, I wouldn't be able to practice it very well. But something as simple as that, if I relax the mind and allow whatever is inspiring me about the practice, whether it's the Brahmaviharas or the paramis, or there's different qualities, or simply the sense of kindness, of interconnection. Like the example I started with is like, is my intention of connection or disconnection? You know, how can I connect? How can I connect with myself? How I connect with someone else? And so wherever that leads, you know, whatever is alive for you around it, that's the important thing. You know, we as teachers, we try to throw out lots of options and hoping that some of them, you know, hope some of them land. And it's better to have one that really lands that you can really go into. Because the Dharma is like a hologram. You go into one aspect, it starts to open up in all aspects. All right, thank you, Austin. All right, maybe one more if there's anyone. Yes.
The core of my question is how to approach right intention when you're in a kind of lose-lose situation, or like if you're working in a broken system. Mm-hmm. I work in a public school, alternative school where a lot of kids are there facing a lot of issues.
Yeah.
And especially this time of year, I'm working with a lot of seniors who are like trying to catch up on a lot of work and graduate. And often I'll be working with a student who lacks a lot of foundational skills. I'll be like making a judgment call, something around like, do I tell the student that they really aren't ready to do this assignment and like you could build up those skills, or do I just do a lot of hand holding and maybe they don't really learn much, but they now have this check. I think that's like something I've encountered in a lot of different ways when I feel like I've kind of been in failing or broken systems and struggle with how, when things kind of feel futile, how to still set an intention. Even when I feel like I'm kind of still trying to approach the situation with compassion, like
yes.
I still want some other way of.
Yes, so the question or inquiry is around how do you, you know, work with intentionality in a lose-lose situation where there's really a broken system, like an example of a scenario at school, you know, and how do you, you know, how do you help people navigate things when it's not clear what's the right way? You know, it's like the system itself may be broken, but there can be this, you know, think of it as there's still the relationship. There's a way you connect with a particular student. And I think that's where the intentionality can really come alive there. So it's like, yeah, this, you know, the choices are not very good. The consequences of your actions aren't very good. There's all the dynamics at home aren't very good. But maybe this one interaction and that power, I mean, think about your own. I often think about my own life. Like I had some teachers that really made a difference. And it wasn't really what they taught. It was the way they were with me. You know, my wife works in the public school system and works with a lot of really, you know, kids with a lot of difficulty. But it's like if she's able to connect with that one student, it can transform that. There can be a little piece there. And so even though the system, you know, is not working, is broken, there's all these pieces, that's one piece you can have a lot of control of. You know, the best of you, sometimes you're cranky, sometimes you're tired, sometimes you're exhausted. And so then the intentionality switches, maybe how can I be compassionate for myself? How can I care for myself? So it's hard being human. It's hard. Some of these jobs are really hard. But I appreciate the question. Thank you.
So are you saying still set the intention despite knowing that the outcome is not going to be positivity? You're saying still have that intention?
That's right, yeah. It's
without the expectation, right?
That's a big piece of it. It's kind of releasing the outcome because you can't really predict what the outcome can be. What can I control is how I meet this one person. How I show up for this person. And yeah, there's choices I can offer to have things, but it's like, you know, how can I do the best I can? Yeah, in an imperfect world. All right, so thank you for all your engagement around this. And you know, intentionality is a really important thing to bring awareness to. And so have a sense of play around it. Notice how the intention comes up. Practice, you know, maybe choosing with kindness versus hatred. See what arises from that. All right, so next week we'll have Tuari Salah continuing this exploration. All right, so thank you all.